This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiya Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Somali cabinet held a meeting, an emergency meeting in Mogadishu. After the meeting, a statement was issued. The statement declares that the null and void says it's against international customary laws and violates the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of Somalia.
That was Haruf Maruf of VOA Somali Service on the deal for landlocked Ethiopia to gain access to the port in the breakaway Republic of Somaliland. Details coming up also. Leaders of Sudan's warring factions have held talks with civilian officials on the possibilities of ending the conflict. And poverty is rising in Nigeria. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A Reuters report says Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces expressed willingness to engage in immediate, unconditional ceasefire negotiations with the Sudanese army. The statement was signed in Addis Ababa with Takadum, a civilian coalition. RSF Chief Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo noted that the same declaration has been extended as an invitation to the army. He emphasized the potential of this document to form the groundwork for peace negotiations aiming to resolve the nine-month-old conflict. The civilian coalition, led by former Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, has been actively exploring solutions to the conflict. The coalition has invited Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan for a similar meeting. Meanwhile, Dagalo, also known as Hamdeti, is currently on a regional tour, marking his first public appearance outside the country since the conflict erupted in April. The tour precedes the highly anticipated face-to-face meeting with Burhan. To gain insight on these unfolding developments, Nabil Biagio speaks with Kalhud Kaher, the director of Confluence Advisory, a Khartoum-based think tank.
I thought it was a very big gamble by the civilians. Initially, their invitation had gone out to both Burhan and Hemeti, but only Hemeti responded. Now, that could be for two reasons. One, it could be that Burhan and the people behind him, like they had done before, refused to agree to a meeting. They have been very reluctant to agree to a meeting. They pushed back against the IGAD planned meeting before Christmas. So this is not outside of their sort of approach to mediation so far. The second reason could be that the invitation to Burhan and the way that it was phrased could have potentially pushed him to not agree to attend. We know, for example, that Hemeti and the RSF have been insisting that Burhan make himself present as the head of the Sudanese armed forces, not as the head of the Transitional Sovereignty Council. And so if the initial invitation went out to address to Burhan as the head of the Sudanese armed forces and not the head of the Transitional Sovereignty Council as well, that may have stopped him from agreeing to come. But without seeing those letters, we don't know quite the reason Burhan refused to attend. I think the surprising thing for a lot of people is that the meeting still went ahead with the other two parties, namely Hamdok and Hemeti. And with so many rumors running around of an alliance between some civilian actors and the RSF, I think the optics of this could have been better managed because a lot of people still have those misgivings.
Taqaddum, this civilian coalition led by Hamdok, is being presented as the most extensive civilian bloc since the Forces for Freedom and Change, which of course played a crucial role in the protest leading to the removal of President Omar al-Bashir. Do you see hope in this coalition? What outcomes can potentially, you know, be achieved by engaging with the warring parties?
I think it's important to have a civilian, broad civilian front. The question is whether Taqaddum is that broad civilian front right now. And there have certainly been a lot of criticisms of Taqaddum from many civil society actors that it's just not inclusive enough. I mean, certainly if you look at the delegation of people who went to meet with Hemeti, there were very, very few women. And it was pretty much the same old names, indicating that, you know, newer voices, younger voices, potentially are not being heard even inside of Taqaddum. And so it's these kinds of concerns that I think will allay people's readiness to join Taqaddum. That said, there has to be a civilian front that engages with the belligerents. The question is, what is the manner of that engagement? They need to be seen as following the interests of the people and not their own political interests, which historically has not been the case for many Sudanese elites. That is a challenge for them right now, to communicate what they're doing, to act transparently, and to ensure that they communicate that they are serving the broader interests of the Sudanese public and not their own narrow political interests.
Yes, and especially after the total failure of the Jeddah negotiations led by the Americans and the Saudis to stop the war or achieve anything tangible, really. And now there's more pressure on Sudanese actors, regional actors, to present something better and to be more transparent, like you just mentioned.
International mediations work on a very different logic to more local mediations. International mediations, whether they are Jeddah, IGAD, AU, or the Cairo Initiative, are much more to do with the countries and the institutions that lead the mediation rather than Sudan and what's going on internally. For example, we haven't seen any of these mediations really pick up on the humanitarian issues or the protection of civilians issues. We haven't seen, for example, the Jeddah talks talk about violence in Darfur as it was happening while the negotiations were ongoing, focusing rather on a national picture, which in many ways obfuscates what people are going through on a more domestic level. And so, you know, these more internationalized mediations have had a very difficult time in figuring out how to respond to events in Sudan, because their lens is not focused on Sudan, but rather on the internal politics and geostrategic interests of the countries that lead the mediations. So that's why there is a gap, really, for more domestic initiatives to take the lead.
Kol Lud Kaher, the director of Confluence Advisory, a Khartoum-based think tank, speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio. Landlocked Ethiopia took the first steps towards gaining access to the sea, signing an agreement yesterday in the capital of Addis Ababa with the breakaway Somali region of Somaliland to access its coastline. Somaliland President Abdi said the agreement included a statement that Ethiopia would recognize Somaliland as an independent country in the near future. Somaliland seceded from Somalia more than 30 years ago, but is not recognized by the African Union or the United Nations as an independent state. Somalia still considers Somaliland part of its territory, and VOA Somali Service reporter Harun Maruf tells me the reactions from officials in Somalia were swift.
Today, on Tuesday, the Somali government responded to the deal and the memorandum of understanding signed by Ethiopia and Somaliland. The Somali cabinet held a meeting, an emergency meeting in Mogadishu. After the meeting, a statement was issued. The statement declares that deal null and void, says it's against the international customary laws, and violates the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of Somalia. Somalia, in protest of that deal, summoned its ambassador to Addis Ababa for consultations and warned Ethiopia against what it called violating the territorial integrity and the political independence of Somalia. Mm-hmm. After the cabinet statement, the president of Somalia spoke to the two houses of parliament, and in his speech, he cited the Ethiopian military intervention in 2006. That's when Al-Shabaab strongly emerged from the Islamic courts. And at that time, the Ethiopian intervention was a rallying cry for some Somalis who supported Al-Shabaab. And the president of Somalia, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, today cited that, and he said the decision by Abiy Ahmed to sign this deal is creating another opportunity for Al-Shabaab to recruit more fighters.
And Harun, you are correct in saying, like, you know, Somaliland ceded from Somalia more than 30 years ago, but it is not recognized by the African Union or the United Nations as an independent state.
The argument from Somaliland perspective is that Somaliland has been working very hard for many years to get international recognition. Somaliland has been having closer cooperation, closer relations with Ethiopia, even though Ethiopia never extended the recognition to Somaliland, but nonetheless, the two sides had closer relations. Somaliland is citing that, it's saying, and they believe that recognition from Ethiopia, if it happens, it hasn't happened yet. So the Somaliland president said it will happen once the agreement is officially signed. On the other side, Ethiopia has this closer relations with the federal government of Somalia. Ethiopia currently has thousands of troops in Somalia, some of them serving as part of the African Union mission in Somalia, and some of them stationed in regions in Somalia based on bilateral agreement with the federal government of Somalia. So how is Ethiopia going to play this role, having closer relations with Somalia and with Somaliland, and at the same time keep both of them happy? That's going to be very difficult.
That is what is so perplexing. How can you have your own soldiers in Somalia and then signing almost a military pact to lease a port with the regional head of state?
President of Somalia today said there's only one option for Somalia and Ethiopia. He said, we have not chosen to be neighbors, but all option we have is to live side by side in peace. It will be interesting to see how the two leaders of the two countries really maneuver that around and keep peace and having good relations.
That was VOA Somali Service reporter Harun Maruf speaking with me by phone. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, opposition candidates continue to reject the results of the country's presidential election. The National Election Commission on Sunday declared incumbent president Felix Tshisekedi the winner of last month's vote. The Election Commission said Tshisekedi won 73% of the vote. The runner-up, businessman and former provincial government Moise Katumbi, had about 18% of the vote. There were 18 other opposition candidates, most of whom won only about 1% or less of the vote. 9 opposition candidates, including Katumbi, signed a declaration Sunday rejecting the election and calling for a rerun. Despite the complaints, the country, nearly the size of Western Europe, has been calm. Reporter Zadem Natizaidi spoke with people in Goma, the largest city in the country's eastern region, to hear what they think should be the top priority for President Tshisekedi's second term. Hubert Masomeko is most concerned about the ending the violence in the eastern region, where more than 100 armed rebel groups operate.
Il y a urgence d'abord dans un premier moment de s'investir avec tout son gouvernement.
He says, first, it is urgent that the president and his entire government invest in peace in the eastern DRC. He said the government's first priority should be to establish peace and state authority throughout the national territory. Masemeko also says the president needs to address the economic situation and inflation and to work much harder on macroeconomic stability. Georges Bihamba says he wants to see peace and security first.
My expectations, which are very urgent, first of all, is the security. Security in the east part of the DRC. You know, it has been a long time our land is attacked by enemies, M23. So now, the first urgent mission that the president should do is to, first of all, to eradicate, to put an end to this war that has mourned a lot of families.
Joshua Intakala suggests different priorities for the new government, education and infrastructure for the vast country.
Il y a urgence d'abord dans un premier moment de s'investir.
He says the president should focus on the continuation of free primary education, which has to be effective, especially in terms of school infrastructure, including buildings. And Intikala says, the second expectation is that we have roads that are completely impassable and that better roads facilitate interprovincial communication. James Bashonga also wants a focus on the economy, especially employment.
I think what the new government should use as the resolution for 2024 or of the second mandate is to fight against unemployment of youth. In DRC, you can see that the majority of young people, they are not employed. And this joblessness in a country determines and it triggers a lot of problems. You can see young people, they don't have any occupation. They're spending all the day home, just drinking, smoking, and going into bad things.
The opposition alleges that chaos at many polling stations, which caused the Election Commission to extend voting another day, favored Tshisekedi and damaged the integrity of the vote. The DRC Constitutional Court is expected to confirm the provisional results on January the 10th. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. Chad's transitional president, General Mahamat Idriss Déby Itno, has appointed as prime minister one of his leading opponents who recently returned from exile. Success Masara, president of the Transformers Party, was a virulent opponent of the government that came to power in 2021 after the death of Idriss Déby Itno, who led the country for 30 years. Masara returned to Chad in November after reaching an agreement with the military leaders. According to the French news agency AFP, Masara publicly urged the voters to approve last month's referendum on a new constitution, saying it would accelerate the transition to civilian rule. Poverty is rising in Africa's most populous nation, creating a major security threat. In 2023, nearly 12% of the world's population in extreme poverty lived in Nigeria. Our reporter in Abuja, Nigeria, has more.
A World Bank report shows Nigeria's population in extreme poverty has risen to at least 71 million people. Extreme poverty is considered an income below $1.90. The World Bank report issued in December also says some government policies have created pressures on the cost of living, pushing more Nigerians into hardship. The policies include the end of fuel subsidies and government efforts to lower inflation. Now, 104 million people live below the poverty line. That's 46% of the population, up from 40% in 2018. Experts say aside from the health implications of hunger, the crisis also poses a security threat countrywide. Economist Bernard Oluwole warns the increase in poverty could be followed by increased frustration, higher unemployment, and criminal activities, which would further worsen the state of insecurity in the country.
The insecurity in the country is high because the economy is affecting everybody. In fact, you cannot even distinguish between the rich and the poor anymore. Even those who are not literate enough to secure a job, they engage in different forms of crime and criminality.
Ada Odo is a civil servant with one of the federal ministries in Abuja. She lamented the high cost of living.
The level of poverty is really telling on me. It affects the transportation system because the little money you have as a civil servant, you think you can manage and it will be enough for you to cater for your family. At the same time, you spend it on transport that is very high. How do we cope? And the salary has not yet been increased. It's affecting me physically, spiritually, mentally.
Pensioner David Alonge called on the government to take the responsibility of lifting Nigerians out of poverty seriously.
I can tell you that since morning I never put something in my mouth, only water. How can you say that Nigeria is okay? It was not like that before now. Nigeria is going down, and at last, poor man We know from where even to live. So anybody who says that Nigeria is okay, that person is not living in Nigeria.
Nigeria faces security threats from armed banditry, clashes between farmers and herdsmen, kidnapping gangs and ethnic or religious insurgencies. In addition to the toll in lives, the crime and insurgencies take a toll on businesses and the country's economy. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
The Moroccan army says it intercepted more than 1,100 migrants trying to reach the autonomous Spanish cities of Ceuta and Melilla on New Year's Eve. The French news agency AFP says they were detained in the cities of Nardor, Medik, and Fendik. The Biden administration's support to Israel in the war against Hamas has drawn sharp criticism both from Americans protesting Palestinian civilian deaths and from State Department staff calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden has been signaling to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he needs to change course or risk international standing. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports. We seem to have some technical difficulties. We'll have that report later on. But moving forward, Peter Magubabi, a South African photojournalist who chronicled the country's apartheid era, including the Soweto student uprising of 1976, died yesterday. He was 91. Magubane also became the official photographer of Nelson Mandela when the anti-apartheid leader was released from prison in 1990 and until he became president 4 years later. In 1969, he was arrested while covering protests in front of the prison where Winnie Mandela and other activists were being held. He was imprisoned and spent 586 days in solitary confinement and upon release ordered to stop his photography activities for 5 years. According to the French news agency AFP, Cultural Minister Zizi Kodowa said, quote, South Africa has lost a freedom fighter, a masterful storyteller and landsman. Peter Magubane fearlessly documented apartheid's injustices.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and